I was in Berlin just after the wall fell. A visit to East Berlin was quite instructive. They were living the low-energy life, no bright streetlights, no neon signs or advertising at all. My West German hosts were still shaking their heads in disbelief. Their government discovered the only thing keeping Russian troops in East Germany was this. The Soviet government was so bankrupt, it could not afford to bring the soldiers home. There was no housing for the troops back home. So German workers went into the Soviet Union to build apartment buildings for them. Then the Russian bases were closed. Is America headed toward the same state of bankruptcy? The United States has bases in over 100 countries. The government puts it all on a MasterCard. They borrow the whole cost from some other countries, the ones who manufacture consumer goods and provide the oil. In an article titled, Portrait of an Oil-Addicted Former Superpower, Michael Clare writes, whether we know it or not, the energy Berlin Wall has already fallen. The United States is an ex-superpower in the making. Today, Radio Ecoshock welcomes a well-published author, professor, and expert on oil, militarism, and geopolitics. Michael T. Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies for the Five Colleges based in Massachusetts. He's a defense columnist for The Nation magazine. His books, Resource Wars and then Blood and Oil, explained our times just ahead of the time. And his newest book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. It has just come out, published by Metropolitan Books. Michael, thank you for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, the issues you cover are as wide as the world itself, so I'd like to zero in on one of those factoids that seems to speak volumes. You write that every day the average GI in Iraq uses approximately 27 gallons of petroleum-based fuels. Well, that's over 4 million gallons a day. I wonder, while Americans are sweating out high gas prices at the pumps, are they actually competing with their own military for oil?
I guess in a sense, in terms of everybody is competing on the planet for what supplies are available, and that, of course, is boosting up the price. Of course, the GIs in Iraq get most of their oil from the Middle East, and Americans at home get their oil from a variety of sources, a lot of it from Canada and Mexico and Venezuela and Africa, so it may not technically be competing, but really we're all in the same boat here.
Well, I'm told the American military is the biggest single consumer of oil-based products in the world. We've got all these warships cruising around, thousands of Air Force flights, the Humvees, all that. What is the impact of this militarism on climate change, do you think?
Oh, my gosh. Well, obviously the consumption of fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal together is the leading cause of global warming, and anything that intensifies the consumption of fossil fuels, like war making, is going to increase the pace of global warming. And I think there's no question that war, because it uses equipment that is particularly fossil fuel intensive, is accelerating global warming. No question about that.
Well, getting to the economy, perhaps. We're told that banks and investors damaged the financial system with subprime loans, but you say high-priced oil really broke the bubble of this American housing dream. How can you explain that?
Well, I guess really it's a combination of many things, but if you look at American housing over the past quarter of a century, because Americans have this predilection, now this is fed by the media, by movies, by culture, we Americans, and maybe it's not too different in Canada, we Americans believe in the so-called American dream, which is that every family has to have a big house on a big plot of land, and the only way you could do that today is to be far from the center of the city, because that's the only affordable lands left in this country. All of the inner suburbs are already completely occupied. So all of the new housing developments built in the past quarter of a century are beyond the beltway, we say, beyond the ring roads that surround American cities, which means they're far distant from any public transit facilities. beyond any suburban railroads or any public transit, which means you have to drive long distances to get to work. And, of course, all those people who drove out to the suburbs to build their new dream houses, many of them bought SUVs in the craze to have giant SUVs. So you have people buying SUVs and huge mortgages they can't afford to get giant homes that need huge amounts of fuel to heat in winter and cool in summer, all simultaneously borrowing all this money when fuel was cheap. And all of a sudden, the price of fuel has skyrocketed, and the cost of these mortgages has skyrocketed all at once. And I think that led to the subprime crisis that's now rocketing the financial world.
So to maintain that lifestyle and that dream, do you think that's directly linked to the wars that we're seeing in the Middle East?
In a way it is, because you cannot maintain that way of life, that American dream, as it's called, without prolific supplies of cheap petroleum. And the only place in the world that has enough petroleum left to supply that way of life is the Middle East. It has two-thirds of what's left of the world's petroleum. Another tenth is in Africa, and another tenth is in the former Soviet Union. And there is no other place in the world that can satisfy, that can supply, sustain that way of life. And all of those areas that I described are inherently fractious. They're divided along ethnic lines. They're divided along religious grounds. They're dangerous. And so American policy has been to use military force to ensure that the United States has access to all of that oil. And so it has led, I would argue, to one war after another.
Well, you know, the U.S. Congress just approved another $165 billion for what I call George Bush's wars, but the government doesn't actually have that money. They borrow more, adding to the $9 trillion debt Americans owe, mostly to foreigners. What happens when China or one of these giant petrodollar pools in the Middle East refuse to loan us more, when they stop buying government bonds?
Well, that point will come when the world economy is in a state of utter collapse, because, or they're ready to face that prospect, because when those countries stop lending us money, that's the point at which they're ready to see the entire capitalist system collapse, because they depend on Americans buying their oil and buying their products as well. I mean, all of these countries have, in a way, become codependent with Americans in our profligate spending habits. That, unfortunately, is the state of the world that we've all bought into at this point. It's all based on consumption, a lot of it generated by American consumption, U.S. consumption. So they lend us money so we keep buying their products, their oil and their other products, and they cut off credit at their own risk.
We are talking with Professor Michael Clare, an expert on oil and militarism from the Five Colleges of New England. His new book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. So what is new in this book?
What I think I tried to show in my book is a couple of things, but one of them is the dramatic impact of China's rise, and after China, India, on the global struggle over what remains of the world's resources. Now, until very recently, I mean to the end of the 1990s, most of the world's resources were consumed by the older industrial powers: United States, Canada, Europe, Japan, Europe, and the former Soviet Union, Russia, consumed the overwhelming majority of the world's resources, whether we're talking about energy or minerals or timber, whatever, you name it, we consumed the lion's share of resources. Now, all of a sudden, you have a dramatic increase in demand coming from China especially, but India is following about a generation behind. China is now the world's leading consumer of things like iron and steel and copper and aluminum and coal and a whole lot of other things. The only thing the U.S. still leads in, by the way, is oil. The United States is still the world's leading oil consumer, but China's catching up in that too. And all of this is happening at a time when the world's stockpiles of many of these resources is coming up to very severe limits. We're probably at the point of peak oil, the point at which the world's oil producers can no longer increase the day-to-day supply of oil, and it reaches a peak of production and goes into decline. We're probably within a decade of peak natural gas. Coal probably will peak before the middle of this century. Uranium probably before the middle of this century as well. Copper, cobalt, many critical mineral resources are becoming in scarce supply. So you have a huge spurt in demand coming from the rising powers of the developing world just at the moment in which we're reaching the limits of the availability of many key resources. This is an extraordinary world crisis that nobody has thought about or planned for or anticipated, and I think it's going to create a global political and economic crisis. And that's what my book is about. Now, I focus on the military and geopolitical implications of that, but the implications are much greater than that.
Well, what is your take on the relationship between this militarism and climate change?
Well, exactly. All of this competition for resources is going to be the norm from now on, like the competition between the U.S. and China, which I think will be the focal point of this competition over the world's remaining supplies of oil, natural gas, uranium, and so on. Now, this competition will be exceedingly costly in the trillions of dollars if it goes the way I fear it will, with a naval arms race, a nuclear arms race, and so on, creating a atmosphere of fear and suspicion. We already see signs of this in Washington, where China is viewed as the enemy to come. If you consider the cost that this will entail in the trillions of dollars, this is money that will not be available to spend on the energy conversion that will be necessary to avert global climate change. So there's a one-to-one relationship between a military competition with China over energy and solving the global warming crisis. You cannot do both.
Well, you know, this really worries me because China's an ancient civilization. It has a real sense of itself as a people. Is anyone in the administration or the military-industrial complex still crazy enough to believe the Chinese people are going to welcome American troops with flowers if a military action does happen? What do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think it's going to result in a direct clash. That's not the scenario that I project. Rather, I see proxy wars arising in Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia as the U.S. and China back rival powers like Sudan, Angola, Nigeria, Libya, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Iran, Iraq, and so on. We already see this pattern unfolding where the U.S. and China are providing arms and military support to opposing local powers in their mutual pursuit of energy, and this would lead to regional clashes that then get out of control and provoke a direct conflict. So I see something much more like World War One or the years leading up to World War One, rather than a direct clash between the U.S. and China.
Can you talk to us a bit more about the new rise of Russia and what that means for Americans?
Exactly. This is another aspect of this pre-World War I-like situation that I fear is arising. In the years before World War I, you had three great empires in collision, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, and the British Empire. And the same sort of three-way struggle is developing now in Central Asia, the Caucasus, and the Caspian Sea area with the United States, Russia, and China, all now competing for geopolitical advantage. And you have U.S. bases, you have Russian bases in the area, and China now is providing arms and equipment. All of them are providing arms and equipment to these countries and to break away ethnic enclaves like Abkhazia, which Russia is backing. So this is a very dangerous stew, much like the Balkans in the years that led up to the Sarajevo assassination that triggered World War I.
I think a lot of Americans are hoping for a big change in administration and perhaps bringing some troops home from Iraq. And yet some peace activists are really dispirited because there's so few signs of public protest these days, no big rallies. Why do you think that is?
Well, now, many people who have been active against the war and have been involved in protests are backing one or another of the candidates. Some have supported Hillary Clinton. I would say many more are backing Barack Obama, hoping that he will bring troops home from Iraq. He has pledged that if elected president, he will begin the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. So I think that energy has moved into the political campaign. Whether or not this will achieve that result is another question, but I think there's tremendous energy that's gone into the political campaign, especially among young people who have flocked to Barack Obama, and I find that a very exciting phenomenon.
Do you have some recommendations coming out of your new book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet?
Well, my fear, as I've said in this interview, is the most dangerous scenario we could expect is a new Cold War or a new arms race between the U.S. and China over energy. So my conclusion from that is that the U.S. and China need to work together in developing energy alternatives. In my mind, I'll put this out there, in my mind, this is the only way the global warming threat will ever be addressed, because U.S. and China are the world's two biggest consumers of energy, especially coal. And it's U.S. and Chinese coal use that is going to be the leading source of global warming gases. Overwhelmingly, the U.S. and China are going to be the leading emitters of carbon dioxide from their use of coal. So if we don't get these two countries to work together in curbing their use of coal and other fossil fuels, there's no hope of averting global climate change. And so I strongly urge cooperation between the U.S. and China in developing climate-friendly energy alternatives, thereby averting global environmental catastrophe and a new arms race.
A kind of a peace conversion that could save the planet. Do you have a website, or can you recommend one where people can find out more about you and your book?
Yes, the place that I do most of my writing is called tomdispatch.com, as in Thomas, T-O-M, dispatch.com.
Good, and I just want to finally sort of ask you, is there something I've missed? Is there something else you want our listeners to really think about?
Well, I think that people have to recognize the importance of the risk that the militarization of energy is taking off. The U.S. really is committed to using military force to get energy, especially in the Middle East and Africa, with the creation of a new Africa Command. I don't know if your listeners are aware that this year the U.S. is activating a new military command for Africa called AFRICOM, And I believe that this is tied to America's growing reliance on African energy. And this is the direction we're headed in.
Michael Clare is the author of Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy from Metropolitan Books. And I want to thank you personally for educating me over the years and a million others like me. And thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.